Hello, I hope I haven't kept you waiting. Come right over. Chair by the window. Comfortable?
Vayidaber Adonai El Moshe Behar Sinai Lemor Daber El Bnei Yisrael V'yamarta Alehem Ki Savau El Haaretz Asher Ani Nosein Lachem V'shavisa Haaretz Shabbos Ladonai. Hashem said to Moshe on Mount Sinai, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel, and say to them, when you come into the land that I give you, the land shall observe a Shabbat rest for Hashem." Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I'm your host, I'm your host, Phil Chernofsky, and this show is for Parshat Behar. Now remember that we in Israel are reading Behar this week. Jews all over the rest of the world are reading Parshat Emor, which I spoke about last week a little bit because most of the show was devoted to Yom HaAtzmaut. So it's going to be confusing for a while, but since Torah originates from Yerushalayim, as the Pasuk tells us, Ki mitzion teitzei Torah u'dvar Hashem miYerushalayim. We will say that we read Parshat Behar this week, but just know that in Chutz La'aretz they're a reading behind, and there will be reading Parshat Emor only because they celebrated, or you, I should say, celebrated the eighth day of Pesach while we were continuing with the weekly portion. And I've discussed that in the past. Recording and first broadcast, Yom Chamishi, Thursday, the 11th day of Iyar 5776, corresponding to May 19th. Got that? The date in the Omer, based on what was counted last night, meaning Wednesday night, is the 26th day of the Omer, which is 3 weeks and 5 days. With all of that said, let us do Tehillim Kuf Lamed, Psalm 130. Shir Hama'alot mima'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli tihyena oznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor ya Adonai miya amod. Ki imacha hasilicha l'ma'an tivarei. Ki viti Adonai kivita nafshi v'lidvaro hochalti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai, ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifdeh et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael, hanetunim batzara v'ashivya, ha'omedim ebein bayam uvein bayabasha, המקום ירחם עליהם ויוציאם מצרה לרווחה ומאפלה לאורה ומשיבוד לגאולה, השתה בעגלה ובזמן קריב ונאמר אמן. Okay, let's address the first verse of Parshat Behar, which I read before, and I purposely continued into the second verse. There is the most common repeated verse in all of Torah, Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe Lemor, and God spoke to Moshe, saying. The pasuk, if I'm not mistaken, occurs 69 times in the Torah. Obviously not in the book of Bereshit, because Moshe Rabbeinu wasn't born yet. The book of Shemot, Vayikra, and Bamidbar are where we find all of the occurrences of that verse. And the book of Devarim, since Moshe Rabbeinu is the speaker of that book, he will refer to the fact that God spoke to him rather, in other words, me, rather than say, and God spoke to Moshe, saying. So it's the three middle books of the Chumash that have the 69 occurrences of Vayidaber Hashem El Moshe Lemor. Add to that quite a number of more times where there's a variation of that. God spoke to Moshe and to Aaron, saying, God spoke to Moshe, and then more of the Pasuk. And this is on the unique side, certainly very rare, that it gives us the location of God's speaking to Moshe, namely Har Sinai, Mount Sinai. Now, what makes this unusual is that our tradition is that God did all of his speaking to Moshe, as far as the Torah is concerned, on Mount Sinai. And therefore, the Torah does not keep telling us that God spoke to Moshe on Mount Sinai. And all of a sudden, we have one instance of that phraseology. And the question is, why? Specifically, the question, based on the next verse, that Moshe was told by God to speak to the children of Israel and tell them when they come into the land of Israel that God is giving them, they shall rest the land and give it a Shabbat. 6 years they work the land, and on the seventh year it is Shemitah. Won't go into all of the details, but you should know that the Torah does. So Rashi asks the famous question, Ma Inyan Shemitah Eitzel Har Sinai? What is the connection between the laws of Shemitah to Har Sinai that the Torah would specifically add the phrase Bahar Sinai to the more familiar verse and say, and God spoke to Moshe on Har Sinai, saying, here are the laws of Shemitah. In order to begin to answer the question, I need to explain a list of 13 Talmudic principles by which we link, or we have for us linked, the written word with the oral law. Let me backtrack. I'm not going to go through all 13 of them. I want to focus on one of them, but I want to explain what I mean. We believe that the Torah was given partially in writing, as in the five books of Moses, and partially, as significantly, inseparable from the written word is what is known as the oral law or the oral tradition, Torah Sheba'al Peh, Torah Shebichtav. The written Torah is the Chumash, the five books of Moses, and the explanations given by God to Moshe to teach the people make up the oral law. I'll have to qualify that in a moment. Now, there are things that we are taught from the oral law that stand, I don't know how to put this really, stand on their own without necessarily linking to the written word. I should have started the other way. There are plenty of things in the oral law that link very significantly to the written word. So the oral law will say XYZ, Shene'emar, as it says in the Torah, and give you the quote. There are other things which are taught as part of the oral law and part of the oral tradition and are linked back to the written word by various principles. Let me give you a different one that we're not talking about now, just to, when I get to the one that applies here, I don't want it to be the only one that I've presented. The oral law, in the form of the Mishnah and the Gemara, the Talmud, teaches us that one of the methods by which a man and woman become married is when the man gives the woman something of monetary value, or money, or something of monetary value. That's called kesef, or shaveh kesef. And there is a legal transaction undertaken between the man and the woman, where the man takes a possession of his, gives it to his intended wife, she accepts it as kesef kedushin, the marriage value or substance with value, and that becomes a legal acquisition. They are now husband and wife. How do we know that that's the way that we marry in Jewish law? The most common method of marriage is giving a gold ring, and gold ring specifically is meant to have no question as to its value. You give a gem, a diamond ring, then it depends, is it a real diamond or something that looks good? Is it a flawed diamond? Is it a flawless diamond? Is it cut well or not cut well? And the value is so fluctuating that we don't know if the transaction can be considered solid, because sometimes if the man gives something of lesser value than the woman thinks that it is, you can have a situation called mekach ta'ut, where the woman says, hey, I thought it was worth much more, I wouldn't have accepted it as a marriage token had I realized how much less it cost. Not saying that women will do this, but it could be like that. A gold ring, and I'm digressing now, I know, a gold ring is the specific tradition that we have. I remember when I bought a gold ring for my wife, the jeweler weighed it, and he charged me, because it was a plain, unornamented gold ring, he charged me the going rate for gold, so that it should be well known to the public, and therefore to the spouse, how much it cost. Anyway, how do we know that this is a valid method of a marriage? The Torah says, ki yikach ish isha, when a man takes a woman. How do we know how a man takes a woman as his wife? So the oral law teaches us that it is, among other methods, by kesef or shaveh kesef, but it also makes a link between the oral tradition and the written word. The specific method that is used is called gezerah shavah, which I would loosely translate as parallel syntax. Specifically, the Torah points to the acquisition of the cave, the burial cave, by Avraham for his wife Sarah from Ephron the Hittite. And there it says, here is the money for the field, kach mimena, take it from me. Kach is the word for take. Ki yikach, when a man takes a woman. So the Gemara teaches us what's called kicha, kicha miste Ephron. We learn that the verb to take means money or something of monetary value has to change hands between the man and the woman because, first of all, because that's the law. That's the halacha. That's Jewish law. But the link is made via the Gezerah Shava. I apologize if this is not clear, especially since it was really just an example and a digression. Let's get back on track. There is another principle that links oral law to Torah law, to written word. They're all Torah law. And that is a long-winded statement. It sounds in Hebrew like this: Davar sheyatza min haklal lo lelamed al haklal kulo yatza. Slicha. Take that back. Davar sheyatza min haklal lo lelamed al atzmo yatza, ela lelamed al haklal kulo yatza. When the Torah singles out a detail from or an individual issue from a general group of issues and teaches us something, it is meant to teach us about the full rule. I know this is confusing. I think I went about this the wrong way, but I hope to correct it in a moment. The Torah says in writing that God spoke to Moshe on Har Sinai and gave him the laws of Shemitah with its details. And how do we know? Because it says so in the beginning of this week's Parsha. So Rashi, quoting a Braita, which is a Mishnah-like writing, says, just like Shemitah was told and given over by God to Moshe with its details, so too all mitzvot were transmitted to Moshe with their details. That's what I've been talking about, even though I probably should have held it over for now. We're talking about a two-step thing. How do we know that God spoke to Moshe the laws of Shemitah with its details? The Torah in writing says it. How do we know that the same thing applies to Shabbat and the Chagim and to all other mitzvot of the Torah? Because we have the say-so of the oral law, and we have a device that we are taught links one with the other, and it says if Shemitah is singled out to be announced, God spoke this at Har Sinai, then that comes to teach us not just about Shemitah, but about all the mitzvot of the Torah. And therefore, how do we know that God told Moshe at Har Sinai to teach us the laws of milk and meat when the Torah is so cryptic in writing by saying, thou shalt not cook a gedi in the milk of its mother, and the oral law teaches us a much broader application of that prohibition? How do we know that came from Har Sinai? Because Shemitah and its details came from Har Sinai. And if Shemitah is singled out to be mentioned as coming from Har Sinai, it's meant to teach us something about all mitzvot. I really apologize because I don't know if I'm getting my point across, but let me go a major, serious step further. How do we know that when the Torah singles out Shemitah to tell us that Shemitah and all of its details were taught by God to Moshe at Har Sinai, that it applies to all the other mitzvot? Well, I just told you how. We know it from the oral law. Yes, but it's not in the written law. Well, what I'm saying, which I feel is an extremely important point, true, it is not in the written word, equally true, as part of the oral law, it has the same validity and status as if it would be written in the written part of the Torah. Wait, but how do we know that? Maybe only Shemitah was given with its details to Moshe by God at Har Sinai, because that's what the Torah says in writing. How do we know this applies to Shabbat? The answer, again I say, to me, extremely important, is something that I summarize with the two-word phrase, Emunat Chachamim. Trust, confidence, faith in our sages throughout the generations. That means we believe and we trust and we take as a matter of faith to the point of certainty that when God said to Moshe, tell the people, show them in the written Torah that they must abstain from all manner of creative activities on Shabbat, explain to them, said God to Moshe, orally, that this includes 39 different categories of melacha, that each category of melacha can be subdivided into toladot, derivative activities. For example, planting is one of the 39 categories of forbidden melacha of Shabbat. And watering a plant, fertilizing a plant, pruning a plant, all of which are necessary for the growth of the plant, are toladot, derivatives of planting, and have an equal status in the prohibitions of Shabbat. All of that, we believe, was taught by God to Moshe to tell us. And our confidence is not just in Moshe Rabbeinu, who received the Torah from God. It is a confidence that applies to every single generation from then to this very own. Hold that thought, and we'll continue with more Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Bahar. You are listening to Torah Tidbits audio for Parshat Bahar. I am still in that Sfirat HaOmer mode, and I don't know what music I can play and I can't play, and I know that I've done things differently in past years, but let's just continue the train of thought that I was up to at the end of the first half. I want to give you a mashal, a parable, an example. Picture a king in ancient times who has an army engaged in a battle, and the king needs to send a message to his general of the army in the field. He calls his trusted messenger, whom the general knows also, and knows that he could be trusted. And he takes a piece of parchment, and he writes on it the letters RTB. And he explains to the messenger how he is to explain to the general the king's meaning of RTB. The king seals the parchment with sealing wax and his signet ring, and sends his messenger on the dangerous mission to find the general in the battlefield. He makes it, he finds the general, and says, General, I have a message for you from the king. The general has his upper staff officers with him, and they sit around the table, and the general takes the scroll from the messenger, looks at it, recognizes the seal of the king, breaks the seal, opens the parchment, and reads the letters RTB, and is puzzled, does not know what they mean, and he asks the messenger if the king told him what it means, and he says, yes, he did. He told me to tell you it means run the blockade. One of the advisors pipes up and says, I recognize that this is a message from the king, but I don't know if we can trust this messenger. I think it would be foolhardy to run the blockade. Perhaps the king meant return to base. RTB, not run the blockade, but RTB, return to base. Now, that's the mushel. In my way of thinking, you either trust the king or you don't. If you don't trust the king or believe in the king or accept the king, then the scroll with the sealing wax and the signet ring won't mean anything, and the RTB can't be trusted, and the explanation of the RTB. Anyone could give an explanation if he wants. If you trust the king, though, and you know the king, and you trust that he chose the proper messenger to give you the message of run the blockade, then that's what you have to do. To accept the scroll as from the king, to accept the RTB as the king's message, because you recognize his handwriting, and to reject the explanation that the messenger is presenting in the name of the king, to me is not an acceptable position. Similarly, Moshe Lamaha Dovar Dome, to what does this compare? To the Torah. We believe the Torah was given by God to the people of Israel through Moshe, his messenger, and that God explained to Moshe how he was to explain everything in the Torah to us. And he passed it to trusted messengers in each generation throughout Jewish history until this very day in the persona of our rabbis and teachers whom we trust. I ran into somebody this morning in the shopping center, and he said, got to tell you a nice thing. And he told me a long Devar Torah, and he told me that he heard it in 1971 from Nechama Leibovich. Nechama Leibovich is someone that I trust when she taught something, and this fellow I trust to be transmitting to me what he heard from Nechama Leibovich. If I didn't, quote, hold by Nechama Leibovich, I wouldn't accept what he told me. And if I had any reason to doubt this fellow, I wouldn't necessarily consider this to have come from Nechama Leibovich. But trusting Nechama Leibovich and her reading and understanding of the Torah, and trusting this fellow who heard it from her and is transmitting it to me, albeit 71, 81, 91, 01, 11, 45 years later, does not change the trust that I put into that particular Devar Torah. So when the Torah says something, and let's use one of my favorite examples, that the tefillin of the head goes between your eyes, bein einecha. That's what the written word says. We say, did God, the king, explain what bein einecha means? And the messenger says, yes, he did. He said that it means on your head, towards the front, up to the hairline. I should add the original hairline, not the current hairline. and it is in the middle, neither to the right nor to the left, which is the significance of between your eyes, bein einecha. Someone else can say, wait a minute, I have the five books of Moses. Let's see what it says. It says, bein einecha. I know what that means. It means between your eyes, which is the bridge of the nose. A person who were to put his tefillin shalrosh on the bridge of his nose because of the literal meaning of bein einecha is A, not fulfilling the mitzvah properly. B, part of A, is considered as if he never took the tefillin out of its case. B, he is rejecting, while accepting the words of the written Torah, he's rejecting the oral law and the oral tradition. The example might not be so great because when you want to know what you're supposed to put between your eyes or on your arm, that's all part of oral law also. The Torah mentions tefillin, but it does not describe them, does not mention that they're made of leather boxes and that they're painted black and that they are perfectly squared and that they contain parchments. All of that is oral law. So the method of understanding and transmitting relies heavily on word of mouth, and that's what I summed up with the two-word phrase, emunat chachamim. We have to have that confidence. I would add that that confidence and belief is so strong that it is equivalent to knowledge. So a traditional Jew, a Torah-observant Jew, does not look at the written word and say, ah, yes, this I accept, and look at the oral law and say, no, this I don't accept. That's not an acceptable position. And that's part of, on my understanding, of Ma'inyan Shemitah Eitzel Har Sinai, by saying that just as Shemitah is given from Har Sinai in its chapter headings as well as its detail, so too all mitzvot were given that way. That is a matter of emunat chachamim. Okay, let me move on to another area. After the presentation of Shemitah comes the presentation of Yovel. Yovel is a counting of 7 years, seven times, seven Shemitah cycles. After 49 years, the 50th year is proclaimed as Yovel, the Jubilee year, and that there are many things that happen at that point. I don't know if I have the time to go into that in detail, but I do want to mention a couple of things. But first I want to say that Yovel does not exist without certain conditions, which include a Sanhedrin, which include the majority of the Jewish people of the world living in Eretz Yisrael, which is something that we are getting close to, not yet there, and haven't been there for about 2,500 years, since the first Commonwealth, the time of the first Beit HaMikdash, there has not been a majority of Jews in Israel. Certainly all during the time, the tenure of the second Beit HaMikdash, the majority of the Jews were outside of Israel, and that was certainly the case with the founding of the State of Israel in 1948, where you had millions of Jews around the world and about 600,000 here in Israel. And now that our population here, Jewish population, is over 6 million, we're getting to that point where we will be the majority of Jews of the world, in which case things will continue moving at a faster pace. Shemitah, on the other hand, which officially from the Torah, according to most opinions, does also not exist without the other conditions, is nonetheless observed by rabbinic law, at least, in many, many respects, and last year was a Shemitah year, and its effect came into this year as far as fruits were concerned, and that we keep alive by practice, but not Yovel. Now, among the things in Yovel are the blowing of the shofar on the Yom Kippur of the Yovel year. Remember, we don't have it today, but when Yovel existed, every 50th year was Yovel, and among many other things, it included the blowing of the shofar on Yom Kippur. We commemorate the shofar blowing of Yom Kippur of Yovel by a token shofar blowing at the conclusion of Yom Kippur every year. That's one of many reasons given for the custom of blowing the shofar at the conclusion of Yom Kippur. We don't do it during Yom Kippur because it's not permitted, but it would be during the Yom Kippur of Yovel. More is that our shofar blowing on every Rosh Hashanah is integrally tied to the shofar blowing of Yovel. I mean as follows. When the Torah commands us about Rosh Hashanah, and it says, Yom Teruah Tehielachem, there shall be a Teruah Yehielachem, a Teruah day, we say, what does that mean? What do you mean, have a Teruah day? So the explanation by oral law is that we sound the shofar, specifically the sound known as the truah, and it's preceded and followed by a single monotone sound, which we call tekiah, and there's a machloket, it doesn't matter, that's not the point. The point is that the word shofar does not appear in the context of Rosh Hashanah in the written word. The Gemara, the Talmud, teaches us that we use a shofar on Rosh Hashanah, and it links to the Torah by that method that I mentioned earlier in the show, known as Gezerah Shavah. The word Chodesh HaShavi'i, the seventh month, which is Tishrei, is mentioned by Yovel and by Rosh Hashanah. Teruah is mentioned in the context of Yovel, and Teruah is mentioned in the context of Rosh Hashanah. So the last connection is made of shofar, which is mentioned by Yovel, connects to the seventh month Teruah and tells us what that means on Rosh Hashanah as well. Again, I have this uncomfortable feeling that I'm not getting across to people who don't know what I'm talking about, and I am unnecessarily reviewing for those people who do. So let's just say that the command to blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah is a little obscured on purpose, and that's a discussion which we can have Rosh Hashanah time, but that's one of the things we get from Yovel. Another point. The Torah, in the context of Yovel, the Jubilee year, warns us not to take advantage in a business transaction for real estate where the number of years to Yovel is important in determining the price. I have to explain a couple of things here, but basically, ancestral land in Israel reverts to its original owners on the Yovel year. And therefore, if you had a piece of land which you, quote, owned, but not really owned, you just, like, have a Yovel lease on it, and you want to sell the rights to it to someone else, you need to disclose to him how many years he will be able to benefit from the produce of the land without obscuring the fact that Yovel is approaching. Now, from there, from that context, we are taught in the oral law that We must be straightforward and honest in our business dealings, and we are forbidden to deceive in business practices. In other words, the written word has the narrow context of Yovel. The oral law teaches us that the command in writing is not narrow to Yovel only. It applies in all business practices. And this is a style of mitzvot. Not every mitzvah is like this. Some are very specific. But there are some mitzvot, the scope of which is much greater than the words seem to indicate. And we only know that the scope is greater by being taught that by the oral law. I must emphasize that I am not talking about rabbinic legislation and extension and interpretation. I'm talking about rabbinic transmission of the oral law. And the rabbis throughout the generations do both. They transmit the oral law, and they legislate and extend and give conditions and modifications, but they are very clear, usually, when they are transmitting something that is halacha l'Moshe miSinai, law to God, from God to Moshe at Sinai, and when they say, by the powers invested in us, we declare such and such. The ban of chicken with milk is rabbinic. The ban of cooking lamb chops in cow milk, where there is no question that it's not the milk of its mother, is still a Torah violation. It is not a rabbinic extension. It's much more than that. It is Torah law. Even though the written word implies only cooking meat in the milk of its own mother. But the implications we are not allowed to draw on our own. We need the oral law to guide us in the proper observance and understanding of all of Torah and its mitzvot. A quick word about Sunday. Sunday is the 14th of Iyar. The 14th of Iyar is Pesach Sheni. Pesach Sheni was a second opportunity, an opportunity given for those people who were not able to participate in the first annual celebration of the Exodus with the Korban Pesach, as recorded in Parshat Baha'alotcha. They came to complain. They happened to have been Tomei for a good purpose, and they were not allowed to participate in Korban Pesach, and they said it's not fair that we should miss out on this great mitzvah, and God gave the command through Moshe, which was part of Torah miSinai, but saved to be revealed at that point, of Pesach Sheni. A person who is Tomei or is not able or can't or doesn't bring or participate in Korban Pesach on the 14th of Nisan is given the independent sort of mitzvah to bring Korban Pesach on the 14th of Iyar. The laws are complicated, but the idea is very important because, generally speaking, when you miss a time-related and sensitive command, you lose it. Let's say a person is sick during Yom Kippur and he can't fast, and then 2 days later he feels fine. There's no makeup for Yom Kippur. Let's say it rains the entire week of Sukkot, and right after Sukkot, Indian summer, beautiful weather, There is no makeup of Sukkot. You don't build a sukkah or dry out your sukkah that got flooded over Sukkot and say, this week I'm going to fulfill the mitzvah, because it doesn't apply. It only applies in its proper time. The one exception to that, really, is Korban Pesach, where God commanded a second opportunity for those who were not able to bring the first, or for whatever reason, did not bring the first. It's an idea that carries with it an ethical lesson of the concept of giving a second chance and having a second chance. It's not its only purpose, and it really has its own restrictions, but it's an interesting phenomenon that in the written word is in response to those people who genuinely felt left out and were disappointed that they weren't able to do this mitzvah. And it is such an important membership right of the Jewish nation that God built into the Torah a second opportunity 1 month later for its fulfillment. Pesach Sheni is really a Beit HaMikdash time mitzvah, but we retain a little bit of the flavor, and some people have the custom to eat matzah on the occasion of Pesach Sheni. Until then, Shabbat Shalom, Lehishtameah.